Hello, welcome everyone to our second session of When Your Kids Push Your Buttons. And I just wanted to welcome you today. We're talking about changing our perceptions. I forgot to mention last week that I do want to let you all know is that we have parents from all across America, plus several each from Australia, Canada, and England. So I thought you might like to know that you're in the company of many international guests. So last week, we focused on identifying and becoming aware of some of the ideas and perceptions and judgments that we hold about both ourselves and our children, and how they can lead us right into our darkest emotions, which then, of course, provoke the reactions that we hate and regret. This week, we're going to look at how we can change that, and then you'll all be all set. But first, I'd like to go over, if someone has one they would like to read, the agenda, the complete the sentence exercise called Your Agenda on page 4 in the workbook. I'm wondering if there's anyone who would like to read theirs. And remember, you can raise your hand by pressing star 2. Teresa, would you like to go ahead and read yours for us?
Okay, thanks, Bonnie. So recently, when my agenda was to write my resume, my child pushed my button by, well, my children pushed my button by fighting with each other and screaming. I reacted by first ignoring and then yelling because I thought they were being mean to each other and rude by interrupting me. My reaction may have had a lot to do with my agenda because I needed them to get along and be quiet so that I could finish my resume. And some other things that were loading my agenda may have been that I was feeling guilty about leaving them in daycare in the future if I do get this job, and feeling insecure about my abilities to work again, having been away from work for so many years, and I was PMSing. And my child's agenda at that time was to spend time with me and have me protect them from each other and to entertain them. I wasn't so sure about that last part, entertain, but we can talk about that later. If I had acknowledged my child's agenda, I could have said, I know you really want to spend time with me right now. I can see that it's important to you. It's important to mommy too, but I need to get this done. So let's set a timer, and a mommy will come and play with you as soon as the timer goes off.
Well, Teresa, I think you did a fabulous job on that. By the way, Teresa has her children are 4 and 2.5, right?
Yes, exactly.
And that was pretty textbook. That was excellent. How did it help you when you did it? Did it help you see different sides of the coin?
Yeah, I think, and this is an excuse, just more of an explanation, that because I have depression, I tend to spiral into negative thinking, and I actually tend to very much believe what I'm thinking. And so when I was thinking to myself, oh, I'm a bad mom because, you know, I'm leaving my kids, it just set off, like you said, a whole chain reaction of thoughts. And how this specifically helped me was really being able to lock onto that and realizing I am not my thoughts.
Oh, Teresa, that's fabulous.
Yeah, really, because I think that's the crux of it for me, is that
yes.
I end up believing I'm terrible.
That is exactly what the whole emotional chain reaction piece is all about in this. And I don't think you have to have depression in order to have this happen over and over and over again. Am I right, everyone?
I'm sure.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you, Teresa. That was excellent. And now I'm going to ask Sabina. Sabina, would you like to read yours?
Sure. Recently, when my agenda was to get to work and to daycare, my child pushed my buttons by not coming to the door to put on his shoes after 3 requests. I reacted by screaming and then escalating to yelling, "Get to the door now," because I thought he would come and do as I asked.
Mm-hmm.
My reaction may have had to do a lot with my agenda because I couldn't be late for work again. Some things that were loading my agenda, or might have been loading my agenda, was that I slept in a bit longer in the morning, that perhaps I should not allow TV watching in the morning, and that if I'm late, I'll get parking further away, making me like have to rush more. My child's agenda at the time was to finish watching a TV program and to gather some toys for the car ride. If I had not acknowledged my child's agenda, I could have said or done, I could have asked him which toys he wanted to take, and perhaps put, or earlier, I could have asked him what toys he wanted to take earlier, and perhaps put his coat on already while he finished watching his TV program.
Excellent. What did that do for you?
The exercise?
Yeah. Looking.
Yes, it's making me realize things from his point of view, putting things into his perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe he doesn't even hear me because he's focused on either watching the TV or taking his time and looking for a toy or a car to bring into the car.
So we see how when we don't take all that into consideration, our assumptions just get fueled, and we assume that our children aren't listening. They're being disrespectful. They're being rude, blah, blah, blah. And so when you pay attention to this, even able to see that he might not even be hearing you.
Yes, but I'm also thinking, maybe it's not a good idea to watch the TV in the morning at all.
Well, right.
So I'm also thinking about that, like avoiding a situation that's causing him to be distracted.
Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Exactly. So. And, this isn't about what you should do in the situation, but you see, when you're able to put all these pieces together, you start to see, maybe I shouldn't do that. Maybe he would do better if he heard this.
Yeah.
Maybe, and so it kind of opens things up.
Yes.
Excellent. All right. And that's great. So I am going to mute you again, and we'll move on here. I want to just reiterate how important it is for all of you to understand that your child's agenda is just as important to him or her as yours is to you. And, we could see by both of those, getting to work on time, getting a resume out to get a job. These are very, very critical things in our lives, very important. And when we just automatically assume that our children should just be on board and be ready to be considerate and understanding and of all the things we have to do, how that can just throw us for a loop. We don't see what the situation is telling us, and we get into power struggles and more difficult situations that take more time and more energy than if we were better at being considerate, at understanding what's going on with them, and getting a little more in the way of cooperation, probably. So the other thing that I wanted you to take a look at during the week was on page 8 in the workbook, looking at how your child's behavior leads to the emotions that you feel, to the reactions you then have, maybe putting down a few examples and seeing if you can identify some of those assumptions. We're going to be talking today as we get on a little further about reframing our assumptions. So it's very important that we, number one, understand what our assumptions are, and number two, how to identify them when they pop up, because, you know, we could write a book with all of our assumptions. They'll just keep changing with every situation. But we do need to be able to identify them. And sometimes we do have very strongly reoccurring ones. I wanted to go over some of the questions that I got during the week that I think might be able to, will definitely help help us understand some of these assumptions before we dig into this. Sabina, who is on the line from Toronto, said that the seminar is helping her really be aware of identifying her buttons, calming her by doing so, and rethinking her reactions. But she's also wondering how to deal with her buttons when the situation is safety-related with her 3.5-year-old son, who she says is ignoring and not listening. And then those, now do we see, does everyone see that the fact that she says he is ignoring me and not listening to me is in fact an assumption right there? Even when you're in a very, very dangerous situation. Her anger and frustration ended with her yelling, "Come back to mommy now," and asking, "Do you want to get hurt?" So when we understand our buttons, that doesn't tell us what to do, like we just were saying in that situation. It just opens up when you start to see the bigger picture. You can see more options, more things you may want to change, not want to change. But when we can understand our buttons, it has all to do with how we're going to do whatever we choose to do. So if a child, I'm going to assume that he's running into the street here. If a child is running into the street, you know, you're of course going to stop him, and fear is most likely the emotion that any one of us would have. But to top that fear with anger and frustration complicates the situation, and so her anger and frustration led her to her reaction of yelling, "Do you want to get hurt?" Now let's look at that. Do you want to get hurt is the reaction coming from an assumption that her son is not listening and should know better, that he's running into the street knowing that a car could hit him and what that would mean for him, and he's doing it anyway. So that, if I think that way, then I'm going to say, you know, something like, "What's wrong with you? Do you want to get hurt?" Her son is running because he's full of energy that he can't contain, and he's 3. So reframing the assumption means looking at it from that perception. He's 3. He doesn't know what could happen. I have to stop him. Defusing a button means you'll likely have fear. I can't imagine any of us not, if a child is running into the street or doing something that is very unsafe. But you're not engaged, you're not enraged because you think he should be listening and understanding. So if you think he should be listening to me, he should be understanding what I'm trying to tell him, that is going to naturally lead you to anger because he's not. So the reframed assumption is going to mean that she will run and grab him without any blame. Does everyone see that? If she's yelling, do you want to get hurt? Stop it. Why don't you listen to me? All of that, he's probably going to block his ears and be less cooperative. Now, there are some kids who are runners. They just run. They're not doing it because they're not listening to you. They're doing it because of their energy level. And the emotional chain reaction, another question about the emotional chain reaction and how to deal with the assumptions and judgments of other people. So my parents, my siblings and friends and other parents who are critical of how I'm parenting is going to cause me to react. This is such a common dilemma. So many parents talk about this. Well, how do I deal with my parents and other people who are telling me I'm not doing a good job? All of that makes us question our parenting, which gets repeated in our head, and it spirals us down. So the thing to be aware of here, and again, I don't expect you all to be able to suddenly magically change this, but the awareness is that when you question yourself, it is itself an assumption. I'm not parenting right. They're right about me. I'm not doing this right. This is what we all kind of stumble into. And that thought then, that assumption, how is that going to lead you to react? Now, does this lead you to go down that black hole of self-doubt and then be conflicting with your kids, with whatever parenting style you choose at any given moment? Or does it motivate you to learn more so you can stand up for yourself? You know, and different people are going to react in different ways. So she also asks, what do I do about all the noise, all the judgments from these other people? Do I explain buttons to them? Or do I just ignore comments? If you're full of doubt about what you're doing, you'll likely get defensive when others make their comments, and you'll go into that self-doubt. If your button is diffused, if that doesn't trigger you, you might be able to say to a person who's saying to you, you know, what he just needs is a good smack or something like that. You could say, I understand your concern. You want the best for him too. I'm learning how to get this right. What I need most is your support. Now, how many of us can say something like that in the moment? And that takes a lot of confidence in yourself. It takes it definitely takes a button not getting triggered. That requires from the start to reframe your assumption to, I don't have all the answers and I need to ignore the criticism from others. Easier said than done, yes. But that's a lot better than, I must be a terrible parent, right? Or, I don't have any idea what to do. Or, they must be right about me, right? Then there's another very related question from Isabella in Quebec, who is also relaying a concern about her parenting style, saying sometimes she's a jellyfish and sometimes she's too authoritarian. I'm sure we can all relate to that. She assumes this sends mixed messages to her kids, which of course it does. How can I avoid this and have them respect the boundaries that they can't always get what they want, yet still have compassion for them, as we talked about last week? So that concern about having compassion for our children even when they can't get what they want. So, yes, of course, when we parent one day based on feeling patient and rested and nothing major going on in our agenda, we can parent one way, and another time of the same day, we're going to be impatient and frazzled and have a very loaded agenda and parent some in a different way. Or we have this idea that I'm not doing it right and suddenly, I'm going to parent differently. What we want is to get that a deep, what I think of as connective parenting is this deep reservoir that we have that's based on principles that are there for us no matter what. You know, whether the pot is boiling over and the baby is screaming, whether or not somebody is criticizing you and telling you you don't know what you're doing as a parent, whether your car won't start, whatever is happening, we want to be able to come from consistent principles and beliefs about ourselves and our children. So that's what we're working on here. So the concern about having compassion for our children yet still setting limits, it is not an either-or proposition. And that's what I really hope to get across to you in this seminar, is that we can set very strict, firm limits and still be utterly compassionate with our children. So, in other words, if you're asking your children to not want something so that you don't have to deal with their whining or crying, then you're asking them to take care of your problem. You see that? If your assumption changes from they have to listen and do what I say to they want what they want when they want it, that's normal, then your emotion will be entirely different. And, of course, so will your response. So the reframing our assumptions is about disciplining our mind so that we can think clearly. And so, as we saw from one of those exercises, we can have more options at our beck and call, more ideas of how to handle the situation more effectively. Any questions at this point? Remember, *2 raises your hand. I guess we'll just move on then, so do be sure and ask a question if you have one. All right, so what we're going to talk about now is the iceberg model of behavior. I sent you all an attachment with that iceberg illustration. And so I want to explain it to you. And so you have that drawing so that you can see. You can do this again and again and again and again with any behavior that comes up that is giving you a hard time. So Webster's definition of behavior is the aggregate response of internal stimuli combined with external stimuli. What that means is that my child's behavior is the final expression of how my child is feeling inside at any given time combined with what's coming at him from the outside. So that internal place, and I'm putting my hands on my stomach right now. I always go there when I think of that internal emotional state that we all have. That internal emotional state is made up of how I feel right now based on something that just happened, as well as an accumulation of how I feel about myself and about situations that have accumulated all the years I have been alive. So what's going on in there has, you know, there's a lot of agenda pieces going on in there as well. So how that internal state is at any given time meets with the external. So my parent, my teacher, my sibling, my friend, my peer, an event that has just happened, whatever it is, that external condition meets with my internal emotional state, and the result is behavior. So the behavior is like steam escaping from a pot of boiling water. It's what has the boiling water has prompted the steam, has made the steam, right? And the steam is escaping, and that's what I see. Now, if for some reason I want to contain that steam and put a lid on it, then I'm going to, you know, try to get a lid. The steam is going to come around the edges, but I'm going to try and squish that steam into the pot, and maybe the lid's going to blow off, all of which I could save myself from doing by just turning off the fire. Let's look at this iceberg illustration. As you can see, that there is the part of the iceberg that is above the surface of the water is the behavior that I see from my child. So, and as we know, all know about icebergs, 90% of the iceberg lies beneath the surface of the water, and only 10% is what we see above the water. And we certainly know that if we ignore the 90% below the surface of the water, we can get in big, big trouble. And we also can get in big, big trouble with our children when we ignore what is going on below the surface, what is going on in that internal emotional state that is provoking that behavior. What we typically do in our parenting culture and have for generations and generations, we see the behavior, the hitting, the throwing, the lying, the cheating, the not, you know, whatever the behavior is, and we either like it and reward it, or we don't like it and we punish it. A lot of it is our personal interpretation of the behavior, too. If I'm feeling particularly tired and impatient, I may punish behavior that I wouldn't pay any attention to if I were feeling fine and not tired and impatient, right? And so when I parent that way, yes, I am sending very confusing signals to my child. But when I understand behavior in the way almost all of us do not understand it, then I know that in order to affect the behavior, I must first understand where it's coming from. Focusing on punishing the behavior alone is like putting a Band-Aid on a bullet wound. And when you understand what motivates misbehavior, punishing it makes absolutely no sense. So misbehavior I have in quotes because there really is no misbehavior. I sort of rewrite that word and say missed behavior, because what I'm doing when I see it as misbehavior, I'm understanding it from the old mindset of my child has to do what I say. So when I understand it in this new way, I know that unacceptable behavior, and again, let me reiterate, never am I an advocate of letting children do whatever they want. I'm very much an advocate for very firm, very strong parenting, which never, ever means disrespect or not understanding, or not having compassion. So misbehavior, quote-unquote, is therefore the representation of an emotional hurt, a disruption, a confusion, a dysregulation, something that is going on in that internal state. And the behavior is showing me what my child is feeling. That behavior is something that I need to be extremely grateful for, because that behavior is letting me know how my child is doing. If it is developmentally appropriate, if it's temperamentally appropriate, it might be annoying as hell, but it means that my child is doing fine. I don't have any concern. Everything is fine. You know, they're laughing and screaming and making way too much noise. Okay, but they're fine. My four-year-old is making a cake on the floor with the flour she saw me using for dinner last night. She's fine. Very annoying, very frustrating, but she's fine, right? It's developmentally appropriate. A child running into the road, a three-year-old, very upsetting, very scary, but he's fine. There's nothing wrong with him. He's just doing what he's doing, right? So I often am talking about this when I have a room full of people who are sitting listening, and I say, imagine if we were a room full of 2 and 3 year olds. Would you be sitting there patiently listening or pretending to listen or whatever? No, there would be pockets of kids all over the room. Some would be climbing up on top of the chairs and the tables. Some would be fighting. Some would be in a corner playing house with mommy and daddy and little children. Some would be, you know, they'd be all over the place. Somewhere along the line, through our, into our teen years and our young adult life, we learn to put a lid on it. And in that same room full of people, I might say, there could be any number of crises going on in the lives of many of you, and I have absolutely no idea. And with our children, we always know. So if I see behavior that is out of control, off the wall, very unusual to my child's development and temperament, then I know I've got a hurting puppy, right? I know that this child is not feeling good, is dysregulated, is upset, is in some kind of emotional pain. So if I know that, why on earth would I punish that behavior? Would I punish that child? All I'm doing is adding insult to injury. I am making the obstacles that she has to get over in order to behave normally, successfully, in a regulated manner, I'm making the obstacles to that far worse. And it's a really tough thing to understand when we have been being parented and parenting with this reward and punishment model of parenting forever and ever. And it really does take a whole new mindset. So in order to get to the root of the behavior, in order to understand the behavior, we must have empathy. We must be able to look beneath the surface of the water, beneath the surface of the behavior, to see all of the things that could be provoking that behavior. So in order to have empathy, we need compassion. And so in order to have compassion, we must change the assumptions that push our buttons and cause us to react. Yes. Who is this from Brentwood, New York?
Hi, Bonnie, it's Nicole.
Nicole, how are you?
Good. I just have a question about some of what you were saying. I have a and 9-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still not, my husband and I are still not completely on the same page about it, but, you know, before we have used punishment or consequences, and now we're switching to not doing that. And how do you have any tips on how to explain the change to your kids? Because, like I said, we're still not 100% on the same page. So last week, an incident came up, and he, as you know, they got upset about something that they couldn't do because it was closed, and my older one actually lashed out and like ripped a poster off of a wall at the place they were at, and he took away her game for a week, her DS game for a week. And then she came home and they were explaining it to me, and he admittedly lost his temper with her. He swatted her, he admitted to me. And they came home, they all told me this, and she said to me, "I thought you weren't punishing us anymore."
Uh-huh.
And I sort of fumbled through my words as to how to explain it, and I said, you know, Mom and Dad need to talk privately, be on the same page, but, you know, can you explain to me in simple terms how to explain that to them? And I apologize if I drop out, my phone battery's almost dead and I'm on the road for work, but I'm listening.
Okay. Well, I think it's very important to be able to say we make mistakes. We have, and it's a great learning opportunity to talk to your kids about times when haven't we all meant one thing and done another. And even when we say, with all best intentions, that we want to give up punishing, we are all very used to behaving in certain ways. And the whole family is into situations like that. The whole family has patterns of behavior. Dynamics are set up within the family, right? And I think you can absolutely say to your kids, we're making mistakes. We want very much to change, and we have reactions. We have emotional reactions to things, and we're trying to understand them. We're trying to learn from them. We know that that was not a good thing. And let me just give a little quick lesson in the do-over, which I think is a really wonderful thing to be able to do, and you've got to wait until your button is no longer pushed. So the do-over means that perhaps your husband, if he feels badly about the situation after it's all over, he can go back to your kids. This is later. This is later the same day. This is the next day. This is 2 days later. This is a week later. It doesn't matter. As long as it is something that is remembered, it doesn't matter. So he can say to them, after everybody's feelings are down about it, you know what? You were absolutely right. We told you we weren't going to punish, and I punished, and I am really sorry that I did that. It was a mistake that I made, and here's what I wish I had done differently. Coming from the frame of mind that I am in right now, being able to look objectively at the situation and not be in this emotional reactivity, here's what I wish I had said to you. Here's what I wish I had done.
Okay.
You know, and in that particular situation, it might be you were really, really disappointed that we couldn't do what you wanted to do. It was very disappointing. It was disappointing for all of us. And we could have talked about what else we could have done. But you see, the ripping the poster off the wall, or is that what you said?
Yes, yes.
They were at a
YMCA and she ripped something off.
Ah, at the YMCA, so in a public place even.
Right, right.
Of course we're going to flip out. Our child is ripping a poster off the wall in a public place. Yike.
Yes. Yes.
Buttons all over the place.
Right.
But after it's over, you know, if you can prevent yourself from from going any further and get out of the place. You can come back, you can repair the wall, repair the poster, all of that when it's over. But to
mm-hmm.
say, here's what I wish I had said, here's what I wish I had done, then you can also, after you say that, you can turn it around and say, is there anything you wish you had said or done differently?
Okay.
And these are wonderful learning opportunities. You know,
yeah, I think it would mean a lot for her to hear that.
Yeah.
That he wished it was to be handled differently.
Right. And I think it's just, it's really a matter of being willing to be vulnerable and open and say, man, we're trying to do things differently and we're making mistakes all over the place.
Yes.
And you definitely have a right to say that when you see it.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Anything else anybody is burning with at the moment? So, you know, when the thing about buttons is to get to the point where we don't react in the moment. And when we don't react, then we can wait until emotions are down, because that's when the most effective work happens. When emotions have subsided, first of all, that's the time, and I bet you've all experienced this, when your child is going to come back and say, I'm sorry, Mommy. And when you can say, I'm sorry to your child, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. The beauty of the do-over is that it's so much more than just an apology. Because children can get parent deaf to apologies after a while. If we apologize and apologize and apologize for our behavior with no change in our behavior, then the apology becomes an excuse for our bad behavior. But when we're working on it, when we're making headway, when we can talk about that with our kids, then we can do this do-over and say, here's what I wish I had said. So back to the iceberg. When you have, let's put, because I know this is very common and it came up in the behaviors last week when we were talking about the behaviors that push your buttons, not listening and ignoring is a big one, right? When your kids don't listen to you, first of all, identify that as an assumption. Very important to realize this is an assumption I'm making that my kids aren't listening. If I think they're not listening, then typically that is going to evoke rage in me. How dare they not listen to me? You listen to me when I'm talking to you, right? So when you think that, that's going to lead you in that direction. So let's look at that behavior and put that, you know, draw your own iceberg, draw the line of the surface of the water, and the behavior goes in the tip that sits above. And then you're going to write down in the root of the iceberg, in the 90% of the iceberg below the surface of the water, you're going to write down every possible reason you can come up with that would provoke that behavior. And believe me, when you do it, when you intend to look at what provoked the behavior, you will come up with it, I promise you. We do this in classes, and they just pour out. It's when we don't bother to look at it and we just say, that is unacceptable behavior, you are being rude, you are not listening, you are not learning, then we react and it's all over. But going back over it, ignoring, not listening, any of you who have children who do that, can anyone give me some ideas of what might be written below the surface of the water. What might be some of the ideas that come up when you see that behavior? Sabina, is this you?
Yes. I quickly jotted down three things. Busy playing, concentrating on something else, watching TV.
All right. There you go. And let's see, Teresa.
The behavior for not listening was running away. And so my daughter wants to go play with her neighbor. And then she has a lot of energy. She's right here. So
yes, that's all right.
What neighbor?
That's all I have right now.
Okay. And then Annabelle?
Hi, my son's nearly 13 and I have a really hard time getting him up and to get to school.
Right.
But he ignores me. My requests. So he's really tired. He finds it really hard to get to sleep at night.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think he really wants to go to school.
Uh-huh.
And this is embarrassing to say, but he's...
Why do you think that he doesn't really want to go to school?
Well, he'd rather be sleeping. He's very overtired.
Yes, he's a teenager, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, they start school too early. He'd rather be sleeping. All his hormones are changing.
Right.
And also, this is embarrassing to say, but he's liking, enjoying, pleasuring himself in the morning.
Uh-huh, yeah. Right.
So, you know, that's... he forgets the time. You know,
right.
Even though he's got a clock, he's just in a daze. He's basically dazed, you know, and overtired. Yeah.
And what do you think about that? What are the assumptions that typically come up for you around that?
My assumption is he's just being deliberately ignoring me.
Okay.
Like, it's just a kind of a bit of locking horns thing, you know. Like,
yeah.
I'm not going to do what she says, you know.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to be a teenager and not do what she says.
Yeah. Like,
and I'll take my time and... You know, she's always rushing me, you know, and, yeah.
So it's like he's doing it on purpose to get you.
Yeah, yeah.
And what does that lead you to feel?
Well, I feel really impotent and like, how do I get this child to move, you know? Oh! So I feel enraged and I don't shout much anymore, but I might just say, come on, we've got to go. It's less of a... Yelling is more of a sort of frustrated way of speaking to him. But I have tried, Bonnie, I have tried the, look, love, I know you're really tired, sweetheart, I know you didn't sleep very well, and I know you'd rather sleep, but look, we've really got to get to school. But he still really resists and resists and resists. So.
Okay, now let me...
But that's an assumption, he's resisting, isn't it?
That he's resisting, yes. Well, he's resistant because he's having a really hard time getting himself to school. He's resistant because, this is something we all have to realize with our teenagers. We do not set the school day according to their natural body rhythms. Their melatonin does not kick in until probably about 1 or 2 in the morning. And not withdraw until middle of the morning. Teenagers have a very, very different body clock than anyone else. So they have a really hard time getting up in the morning and being at a school desk paying attention to things that they don't want to pay attention to at 7 o'clock in the morning. But let me say one thing. The things that you were saying to him, the understandings, I know that you don't want to get up. I know you'd rather stay in bed, but you have to do this. And even before you said the word but, I heard it coming. Did everyone hear that? when we say something like, I know you're angry about that. I understand that you'd rather keep watching television. You can just hear the but coming, can't you?
Mm-hmm.
And whenever that but comes up, it's like a verbal eraser.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have been before is gone. The but tells your child that you don't really care. You might understand what's going on, but you don't really care.
Mm.
Because what comes after the but is all you really care about.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah,
true.
Yeah.
It's true. But you have to go to school. He knows
mm.
that. He knows that. So wherever it's possible to just eliminate the but, it also changes your tone of voice. So instead of, I know that you're really tired and you'd rather stay in bed, but it would, when you don't have the but, when you're not thinking in that way, you come
yeah.
at it with, oh man, you would just so rather stay in bed today.
Mm.
Ugh, it's gray out, it's rain, it's early. You really don't want to get out of bed.
Mm.
Period, right? Then, after the period, see what that is doing is empathizing with what's going on at the root of the iceberg, right? You're showing some compassion.
Mm-hmm.
You're acknowledging, you know, I remember, maybe you even add, I remember when I was in high school and, oh my God, I just hated it so much.
Mm-hmm.
So hard to get out. And then you might go with maybe nothing right there at that moment. He knows he's got to get up and out. But maybe later in the day you talk about mornings with him and say, you know, acknowledge that you really understand how hard it is. And what could you do or he do that would make it easier for him in the morning?
Mm.
Does it make sense? Does he want you to wake him up? Would he rather have an alarm clock?
Mm-hmm.
How would he like it? What would be better for him if you came and sat on the edge of the bed and rubbed his back and slowly woke him up? Or if you just called from the doorway, what would he rather?
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have to make it work for you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how much time you've got and all of that. So you can, that you can discuss during the day, like
mm-hmm.
in the afternoon. But at the time, just try being empathetic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's just hard when he actually gets out of bed and he just would take forever to get dressed and, you know?
Yeah.
And then he's
so
got two minutes to eat his breakfast. And
can you let it be his problem and not yours?
Yeah.
This is
yeah.
another huge piece of parenting. When we take responsibility for our children's problems, then they learn that they don't have to take responsibility themselves.
Yeah.
If we're going to be on their back, nagging them, telling them what to do, getting, making sure we're pushing them, getting their homework done, doing this, making sure this happens, then they don't have to think about it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But when you can let being late to school be his problem,
yeah,
then things start to change.
Thank you, yeah, no, thank you. That's great.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. The most important reframing of an assumption that you can think about, and this needs to be the billboard above all behaviors. When you see unacceptable behavior, that is your cue to think, my child is having a problem, as opposed to my child is being a problem. Right? So the old assumption is my child is being a problem. When I think my child is being a problem, then I have to do something about it. I have to make sure, if I am a responsible parent, I have to make sure he changes. I have to make sure that I do something to ensure that this doesn't happen again, blah, blah, blah. And we're in our heads, and it's all about us and what he's doing to me and how he's messing up my day and my agenda and why, what have I done wrong to lead him to this point and blah, 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 blah. We're in our heads with all kinds of crap. If I'm going to be more effective, then what I need to do is change that to he's having a problem. All behavior that is not developmentally appropriate, that is not temperamentally appropriate, that is coming out of left field, that is something that is just not okay, that means my child has a full load underneath the surface of the water in that internal emotional state. There is something that is a need that is not being met. There is a need that is not being understood. There is a something that is causing your child to feel powerless. So here, what you can almost always start with when you're doing this diagram under the surface of the water, you can almost always start with, my child is feeling powerless, my child is feeling unaccepted or misunderstood. And then just see where that leads you. You know, and maybe part of the reason this this child is not going to getting up and going to school on time is because he's not motivated to be there. You know, what's going on at school? That's another place to look. And there are all kinds of things that go on at school, especially at any age, but especially when you get into the teen years, that you're not going to know about. You know, who said something to him? Does he have a crush on another, on a girl, and she told him or gave a clear signal yesterday that she wasn't interested? He got a bad mark on a test, and he doesn't want to tell you about it. All kinds of things are going on with our children that is provoking their behavior that may look to us like laziness, that may look to us like they don't care. And then they also get very defensive, too, which means they're defending something. They're keeping themselves from telling us something that they don't want us to know because they might be afraid they're going to get in trouble. Or they don't want us to know because they don't want us to be disappointed in them. So lots and lots of stuff there. So work with that iceberg and see what you come up with. And know that what your child needs is empathy and compassion for what is going on beneath the surface of the water, which you don't want to ask questions about, but you can make statements about things like, I notice that you've been really provoking your sister a lot, and I'm wondering if she is just particularly annoying you lately. It's just really hard. Or I wonder if you wish you had more of my attention. You see, these are statements that end with a period, not a question mark. And that is going to be more of a bridge to a conversation than a question, which sets children up. They don't know what you want when you ask a question. When you're trying to elicit something from them and you ask, why did you do that? Why are you feeling like that? What's going on? Who started it? You're not going to get answers. Or you're going to get answers that you can't really depend on because they might be answers that are going to be defensive answers. Answers that your child thinks he's got to give in order to not get in trouble or, as I said, to not disappoint you. So make statements. All right. More in terms of reframing assumptions. Again, this is about disciplining your mind. It's like mindfulness. You know, we're paying attention to what we're thinking. we're taking responsibility for our thoughts that then lead to our emotions and our reactions. This is how we take responsibility for ourselves. And when we do it for ourselves, we become a model for our children. So reframing your assumption doesn't mean that you let it go, you give in, or you ignore the situation. It doesn't mean that at all. It means, you know, the egocentric child still has to cooperate. The jealous sibling still must stop the hitting. The demanding child is still exhausting, and the child who hates school still has to go. But, and here's my big but, your reaction to the situation will be less volatile. You will be better able to disengage in order to connect with that beneath the surface of the water area, to see your child's point of view and to empathize. You'll be in a better place to maintain your authority and be clear about what needs to be done. Without all that blame and that angst and the threats and the punishments, you don't need to do that anymore. When you make assumptions, I'm focused on what my child is doing to me, how inconvenient she's being, what a problem she is for me, how her behavior is reflective of me. So with my daughter, I think I told this story in the initial interview with Jacqueline that you probably heard. When my daughter and I were in power struggles every single morning when she was in preschool, my assumption was that she was out to get me. And that drove me every single morning. And then that one morning, you know, her lip was sticking out, her face was all scrunched, she was whining and grumpy and crabby. Nothing changed from her. And this had been going on morning after morning after morning after morning. Then one morning, same face, same everything. And instead of thinking she's out to get me, I thought she's miserable. I did a 180-degree switch from what she was doing to me and how angry that made me to seeing what was going on for her, which just, I mean, the compassion just poured up from me. It was like that thought change, that mindset shift, when I saw she's not doing this to get me, she's miserable. Then it was all about compassion and what could I do for her. And then all of the stuff about me went away and my head was clear. And I could think. And I plopped myself down on the floor, and I brought her onto my lap, and I said, Molly, you don't want to go to school this morning, do you? She said, no. I said, you just wish you could stay in your warm, cozy bed and your warm, cozy pajamas. Yes. And you don't want to get up and put on those cold clothes and go to school and leave me. And she said, no. And meanwhile, she's melting into my body. And I realized when I felt that her body just drop into mine, I realized that it was the first time she got that I understood her. And it was like we were blood sisters, you know. We were just, I understood. And I said to her, you know what? She said, what? I said, I hate getting up in the morning too. She looked at me like I had three heads and said, you do? I said, absolutely, I hate it. I hate pushing the covers back. I hate getting up and getting out of bed. And then it was just like, really, we just totally were in sync with each other. And then, you know, my head was clear and I thought about ways I could help her and motivate her. No longer was helping her get dressed if she needed that. No longer was that a problem, right? Didn't matter to me. You know, before it was like, she's plenty old enough to dress herself. I'm not dressing her. She knows how to do it. That was all gone, all gone. And some mornings I said to her, do you need help getting dressed this morning, Mom? And she would say, yes. And then I'd had no problem. And other mornings she was perfectly motivated. And we had this little game we played with coins in these little decorative jars. And we had a little contest of who got dressed first. And we played fair. I played totally fair and square. And often I would get dressed first, and I would put the penny in my little jar, and sometimes she got dressed first, put the penny in her jar, and then when the 10 pennies were up, we would dump out the jars and count who had how many and start them all over again. You know, it could have been stones or beads, didn't have to be. Nobody got the pennies. Nothing. There was no reward involved. It was just this fun little game that we played, and it lasted for a long, long time. So our perceptions of our children are filled with our energy. And whenever we perceive something from the assumptions, whenever we have those assumptions, those perceptions, then we have opinions about it, we're putting out energy that is felt by our child. It's like that illustration of the gap. On the other side of the gap, what is my child getting from the energy I'm putting out? Certainly not understanding, certainly not wanting to be there to help. They get that antagonistic energy that we're resisting their resistance, and so we're creating this battle. And when we make assumptions and criticisms and judgments, that it's like that energy is just leaking out from us. So, for instance, I might have an assumption that my child is lazy. How can you be so lazy? Or why won't you ever do what I ask? That sends energy to the child that causes him to feel put down or belittled or uncared for. Right? It's just energy that goes with that message across the gap. But when I reframe that, and I think he's procrastinating, I know that you don't want to do what I've asked you to do. You would much rather talk to your friends or stay in bed. I need to know exactly when what I've asked you to do will get done. I need to know when you're going to be downstairs ready for breakfast. That sends energy to the child that causes him to feel acknowledged and understood, yet still accountable. So you're not messing everything up with this negative energy that is, we think, is maybe motivating, but it's not. So reframing our assumptions means allows us to disengage and be more objective and not take it personally. You see, that's a big piece of it. When you can identify your assumptions and the negativity from those assumptions, you know for sure this is behavior that I'm taking personally. And that means if I'm taking it personally, that means I'm responsible for it. And I have to do something about it, and I have to change it so I don't feel the pain or the discomfort or the inconvenience or the anger, so that I don't have to deal with that. So we try to make our children change so we don't have to deal with our problems. We make them responsible for our problems. Does everyone see that? That's a big one. You are not responsible for your children's behavior, for your children's emotions, for what they think. You are not responsible. You are, however, 100% responsible for everything you say and do. And that's what creates good boundaries. When I know on my side of the boundary what I'm responsible for, what my problems are, and I know on my child's side of the boundary what he's responsible for and what his problems are. And I'm not going to take care of his problems, and I'm not going to ask him to take care of my problems. That's what a boundary is. It's a psychological boundary. And so many of us were not brought up with good, healthy boundaries between our parents. Now, what that means is not, this is your problem, I'm washing my hands of it and walking away. You're on your own, kid. It's not what that means. But when I know that it's my child's problem, then I can ask if he would like to have my help. When I have a problem that I know is mine, I'm frustrated because you won't come to the table and you'd rather watch television. That's my problem. But when I recognize it as my problem and I put it out as my problem, then I can ask my child to help me with my problem. Now, it's all in the tone of voice. It's not that I'm saying, I know this is my problem that I want you to come to dinner and I want help with my problem. It's just that you're going to say it in a more considerate way. If I allowed the television there in the first place, then of course my child would rather watch television and would be very happy if I would just bring his dinner to him. If I want him at the table, I need to ask for his help with my problem. I want everyone at the dinner table, and I need the television off. Do you want to turn it off yourself, or do you want me to turn it off for you? But you're being responsible by saying, I want you at the table, as opposed to, you get into this into the dinner table now. Turn off the television. How many times do I have to ask you? See, that's just fraught with blame and negative energy. When I say, I want you at the table, how am I going to get your cooperation with that, then we can, you know, my child feels more heard, that I'm having a little more consideration, right? It's taking agendas into account. By the way, there are four main concepts that I want you all to keep in mind through this program. One is the emotional chain reaction. My child's behavior is what causes me to have assumptions about that behavior or assumptions about myself. It's the assumptions that lead to my emotions that lead to my reactions. Agendas, remembering that your child's agenda is just as important to him as yours is to you, so that there's consideration. Everybody wants different things. We all just want what we want. The gap. Asking yourself, how is my child hearing what I'm saying right now? Am I making connection or am I breaking connection? Am I being understanding and considerate and still firm and asking for what I want? Or am I blaming my child and is he hearing that he's unacceptable? And the iceberg. What's this behavior trying to tell me? What is the problem my child is having as opposed to being? So the emotional chain reaction, agendas, the gap, and the iceberg. They kind of go through all of this. Take a look on page 9 in your workbook. And I'm not seeing any hands raised. Know that at any time you can raise your hand by pressing star 2 if you have a question or comment. On page 9, steps for reframing your assumptions. First, acknowledge and accept the emotions you feel. don't try to change them. You know, that's what we do a lot of the time, especially women. We say, if only I didn't get so angry, or why do I have to feel so guilty all the time, or what is wrong with me that I... And we just make it worse, don't we? You know, it's just we feel guiltier, we feel worse than ever when we criticize ourselves for the emotions we have. I believe that our emotions are there, that we can't change our emotions. They just come like, you know, like the steam from the boiling water. They just come. What we can do is change what we think, which is what will in turn change our emotions. But don't, your emotions are telling you very important things. So don't belittle them, don't dismiss them, don't try to be happy and cheery all the time. Have your emotions, they're real. Number two is take responsibility for your emotions and your reactions instead of blaming them on your child. Realize that it was an automatic assumption that caused your reaction. Ask, what must I have been thinking in order to make me feel that way? Realize that your assumptions, your thoughts, are your perceptions, and that your child or anyone else may have a very different perception. Check the accuracy. Ask yourself how realistic your assumptions really are. Now, this is hard because if I make an assumption that my child is mean, you know, this is maybe a child who is hitting his sibling all the time, poking, provoking, verbally putting them down, on and on and on, all of this stuff. Of course, I'm going to think very easily, he's mean. And that is a statement of fact. How am I going to think otherwise? That's where we get stuck, you see, because he's mean, is it a judgment or an observation? He's mean is a judgment. Anything that is a judgment is an assumption. Any reframed assumption must be an observation. If I'm thinking he's mean, then that means, of course, how am I going to feel about that, and how am I going to react to that? When I look at the behavior, the hitting, the poking, the provoking, the prodding, the put-downs, put all that up in the tip of the iceberg, and then write down below all the reasons you can possibly come up with. And these are assumptions, too. You don't know all of these for fact. Much of this is assumptions that you're making, but these are assumptions that are going to help you get to compassion, right? These are reframed assumptions. So he's jealous. He wishes he had my attention all the time. He's feeling blamed for everything he does. He thinks that I love his sister more. We do this so easily, and typically we will feed. This is what happens on the other side of the gap, right? This is a child who's going to feel unaccepted, who's going to believe he's a troublemaker, and children behave in the way they perceive they are expected to behave, which means if he believes he's a troublemaker, if he believes that I think he's a troublemaker, then he's going to keep behaving like a troublemaker. Sad but true. So if you are stuck on an assumption like he's mean, look at your reactions whenever you think that way. Are your reactions effective? Are your reactions helping your child change his behavior? If not, if your reactions are ineffective, if you regret them, if you're still yelling and screaming, then that is your cue to go back to your assumptions, because it is the assumption that is making that happen. So so then, instead of he's so mean, this is where I want to reframe it. And maybe I'm going to say instead, he has a really hard time every time his brother is around. His brother is reminding him that he has to share his parents with him. His brother is reminding him that his brother has an easier time in life, has more friends, does better in school, is a better athlete, whatever. That's going to take me to compassion, right? So then, you know, you're writing down these corresponding but different ideas. They're observations that might be more accurate. And the questions on the bottom of page 9, go over that when you have time and see if you can write some things down there. And another way of doing the same thing is on page 10. So my old assumption, she thinks the whole world revolves around her. A reframed assumption, she's in an egocentric stage of development and naturally wants what she wants when she wants it. Do you see how each of those lead you to feeling different? And it's not like one is countering the other. One is more specific, more factual to the situation and has no judgment attached to it. We just did that he's being mean. Her demands are sucking me dry. Might change too. She's a really persistent child and I have a hard time parenting her alone. You see, it's just, that's going to help you see that this is really difficult, but you're not putting her down for it. And you'll get help, although all of you right now are. So you've learned that. He's lazy and he'll never graduate. Maybe you think he hates school. He's having a very hard time being motivated to do anything he doesn't want to do. This is very typical, especially of teenagers. So when we're dealing with older kids, we've got to realize that their egocentricity comes back in full. It's often said that a 12-year-old is similar in development to a 2-year-old, and a 13-year-old is like a 3-year-old, and a 14-year-old is like a 4-year-old. It's interesting. But yeah, in those latent years, in like 9, 10, 11, you have these just great kids. For the most part, they're usually helpful, cooperative, not always, but... And then they go into the teen years, and you think, where did my child disappear to? What has happened? All right, so on page 10 at the bottom, if you haven't already been doing this, write in some assumptions that you have and reframe them on the right. And then... For your homework, I'd like you to do the complete the sentence exercise on page 12, and you have an example written in on page 11. And we'll, again, read a couple of those next week. And then on page 13 and 14, these are all just different ways of going at the same problem, different ways of thinking about what are the assumptions I'm making? What can I do about them? How can I change them? So you're going to write in your situation on page 14. On the example on page 13, there are three bullets under each one, three examples. The first bullet goes with the first bullet in each one of the topics. The second bullet goes with the second bullet, and so on. So there are three separate examples that I've given there, okay? And then on page 15 is one of three practices. Well, if you do both parts, part two as well, there are practices that I fit in here. And it's just for you to read over. This one is called Become Aware of Your Thinking. It's another way to just help you focus. So just look that over and use it however you want. And if you're reading or listening along in the book, read chapter 5. So, if there are no questions, and do raise your hand if you have one, star 2, and I'll read through an example here that I have, and anytime I see a hand raised, I'll cut out for it. Let's look at this behavior. Homework is not getting turned in. So I may be having a lot of thoughts and feelings about that. My assumption, he's lazy and never applies himself. He thinks he's on a free ride. My emotion is fury. My reaction, yelling, withdrawing privileges. Or saying, what's this I hear about missing homework, young man? What do you spend all your time at school doing anyway? No son of mine is going to slough off in school. There will be no more baseball for you until the situation changes. Or much more typically these days, I'm taking away computer privileges, taking your cell phone for a week. Those reactions, you know, are not going to get you anywhere. All you're going to do is cause more fury in your child and more resistance and more digging in his heels. My new assumption might be he must be having a difficult time learning this stuff. It's either too hard or he's bored. He needs help and motivation. So you want to focus on the principle that all children want to be successful. And when they're not being successful, it means there is an obstacle in their way. So I'm going to look at what those obstacles might be. And using the iceberg model helps us figure that out. So if I hold this different assumption, he must be having a hard time learning, or he must be distracted and forgetting that maybe he even has his homework done, but he's not handing it in. His agenda is far from paying attention to his homework right now. He cares much more about what other people are saying and doing, what he's wearing, what other people are wearing, what they think of what he's wearing, you know, all the things that go on in this kind of a situation. If I think in this new way, my new response might be, your teacher told me that you've not handed in your homework for a while. I'd like to hear your side of the story. What is it that, how would you respond to that? Tell me what is going on for you. I'm going to do that before I'm going to say, what do you think you're doing? Get your homework in or you're going to get terrible grades and then you're not going to pass and, you know, all the things we catastrophize to. So this is actually being much more objective and able to hear, giving your child the chance to tell his side of the story. And let me ask you all this. When you were growing up, and you got into difficult situations with your kids, with your parents, and your parents were upset with you, did you have the opportunity to tell your side of the story? Did your parents give you that option? Did they want to hear your opinions and your decisions and your point of view about things? Did they want to hear what you had to say as opposed to what a teacher or another adult had to say? Were you innocent until proven guilty or guilty? And if you didn't have the opportunity to tell your side of the story, then it's going to be very unlikely that you are going to automatically give that to your child. So that means you've got to be very aware. You've got to know that that doesn't come naturally for me. I've got to stop. I've got to think. I've got to say, I want to hear what you have to say about this, and mean it. All right, so if there are no questions, I'm going to end today's session. And next week we will be moving on to expectations, which are very, very powerful. So I will end. You can send me questions, especially those who are not live on the call, who are listening to this. You can send questions.